This is a continuation of Appendix 12 from The Unknown Reality by Jane Roberts, A Seth Book, Volume 2. Okay. First of all, Rob says that he's happy to note that Seth's ideas oppose much of the quote-unquote modern thinking that we're fated to bring about our own end as a species, whether by nuclear warfare or in some other equally devastating way. From his own viewpoint, Seth recently discussed such fears in a session given for Jane's ESP class. So this is what Seth said. In certain terms, the theory of evolution, as it is conventionally held, has caused unfortunate beliefs. For how can you look at yourselves with self-respect, with dignity, or with joy, if you believe that you are the end product of forces in which the fittest survive? Being the fittest implies those given most to what would appear to be murderous intent. For you must survive at the expense of your fellows, be you leaf, frog, plant, or animal. You do not survive through cooperation, according to that theory. And nature is not given a kind or creative intent, but a murderous one. And if you see yourselves as the end result of such a species, then how can you expect goodness or merit or creativity from yourselves or from others? How can you believe that you live in a safe universe when each species exists because it survives through claw, if it must hunt and kill out of murderous intent, as implied in the theories of evolution and of reality itself? So, when you think of your beliefs and who you are, you must also think of your own species and how you are told your species came to be. For your private beliefs are also based upon those theories and the beliefs culturally of your times. It is seldom that you really question your biological origins, what they mean, and how you interpret them. Are you physically composed of murderous cells then, each spontaneously out to get the others? If so, your physical being is more miraculous a product than even I have ever told you. If your cells did not cooperate so well, you would not be listening to this voice, and it would make no sound. As you listen to me, the cooperative, creative adventure within your bodies continues, and in terms of continuity, reaches back prehistorically and into the future. Because consciousness creates form with joy, there is no murder that you have not projected out of misunderstanding and ignorance of the nature of that consciousness. Roots do not struggle to exist. One species does not fight against the others to live. Instead, creativity emerges, and cooperatively, the environment of the world is known and planned by all the species. What appears to be struggle and death to you at those levels is not now, for the experience of consciousness itself is different there, as is the experience of your own cellular composition. Okay, and then Rob notes here before the next excerpt that soon afterwards Seth had this to say in a private session. So again, here's Seth. He states, "Your body knows how to walk. The knowledge is built in and acted upon. The body knows how to heal itself, how to use its nourishment, how to replace its tissues. Yet in your terms, the body itself has no access to the kind of information the mind possesses. Being so ignorant, how does it perform so well? If it were scientifically inclined, the body would know that such spontaneous performance was impossible, for science cannot explain the reality of life itself in its present form, much less its origins. consciousness within the body knows that its existence is within the body's context and apart from it at the same time. End quote by Seth. Okay, so right here, Rob inserts, stating, I repeat that when Seth discusses evolution, his meaning differs considerably from the scientific one, which, with various modifications, is even accepted by a number of religious thinkers. As I show at the end of this appendix, Seth allows for a much greater range of simultaneous origins. In our reality, these imply growth and development out of that quote-unquote basic group of species for the most part, with multidimensional purposes operating inside an enhanced time scheme that includes probabilities, reincarnation, counterparts, precognition, and other concepts, meanings, and beliefs. All of these qualities are manifestations of all that is, or consciousness, or energy, or whatever. Probabilities aside, when Seth talks about cells or their components recombining as parts of plants or animal forms, as he does in the 705th session, Jane and I don't take that to mean the evolution or alteration of one species into another, but that a unity of consciousness pervades all elements in our environment, whether quote-unquote alive or quote-unquote dead. With the concept of probabilities in mind, however, much of the, quote, thrust for development and change, end quote, that Seth also mentions as existing inside all organisms could just as well take place in those other realities. Early in this appendix, I described how Seth continually built upon material that he'd given before, and that processes of correlation between old and new resulted. At this time, my ideas here represent a correlation between Seth's material on evolution in the 705th session, which led to this appendix, and his later statements on origins. We hope to learn much more about the whole business of evolution. And behind all, Seth insists upon the condition that each of us chose to experience this camouflage reality within this historical context. Okay, so Rob says also that his thought is that because of that choosing, common denominators must lie beneath the clashing beliefs about evolution, and that a good place to start looking for such unifying factors is within the theory or the framework or idea of simultaneous time. However, one wants to try to express such a quality within serial terms. The search would be a complicated one. At the same time, Rob admits that ideas like this always remind him of Seth's comments in the class session for June 23rd, 1970. As excerpted in the Appendix 4, Seth speaks. So Seth states, in this reality, each of you very nicely emphasize all the similarities which bind you together. You make a pattern of them, and you very nicely ignore all the dissimilarities. If you were able to focus your attention on the dissimilarities, merely those that you can perceive but do not, then you would be amazed that mankind can form any idea of an organized reality. End quote by Seth. Alright, so, right here Rob says that the next two excerpts to be presented from Seth came through in a couple of sessions delivered sometime after Seth had finished Unknown Reality. Rob put them together for easy reading, he says. Their inspiration was Rob's work here in this appendix and the discussions on evolution that Jane and Rob led in ESP class. As noted with the quotations given in note 13, eventually this material will be published in its entirety as part of a Seth book. Perhaps then it can be used as a guide for the sort of investigation just mentioned. In the meantime, the thoughts below can at least help orient some fresh thinking about the beginning of our planet, of all the species upon it, and indeed of the universe itself. So Seth stated, "There are verbal difficulties having to do with the definition of life. Your own kind of conscious mind is splendid and unique. It causes you, however, to interpret all other kinds of life according to your own specifications and experiences. There is no such thing, in your terms, as non-living matter. There is simply a point that you recognize as having the characteristics that you have arbitrarily ascribed to life or living conditions. For there is no particular point at which life was inserted into non-living matter. If we must speak in terms of continuity, which I regret, then in those terms, you could say that life in the physical universe on your planet, quote-unquote, began spontaneously in a given number of species at the same time. Words do nearly forsake me. The semantic differences are so vast. In those terms, there was a point where consciousness through intent impressed itself into matter. That quote-unquote breakthrough cannot be logically explained, but only compared to, say, an illumination, that is, a light occurring everywhere at once, that became a medium for life as you define it. It had nothing to do with the propensity of certain kinds of cells to reproduce. All cells are imbued with the quote-unquote drive for value fulfillment. But with an overall illumination that set the conditions in which life was possible as you think of it. And at that imaginary, hypothetical point, all species became latent. The inner pulsations of the invisible universe reached certain intensities that quote-unquote impregnated the entire physical system simultaneously. That illumination was everywhere then, at every point, aware of itself and of the conditions formed by its presence. At the same time, EE units, or electromagnetic energy units, became manifest. I have said, for example, that the universe expands as an idea does, and so the visible universe sprang into being in the same manner. The same energy that gave birth to the universe is, in those terms, still being created. The EE units contain within themselves the latent knowledge of all of the various species that can emerge under those conditions. It is according to your relative position. You can say that it took untold centuries for the EE units to quote-unquote initially combine, forming classifications of matter and various species. Or you can say that this process happened at once. In your terms, each species is aware of the condition of each other species and of the entire environment. In those terms, the environment forms the species, and the species forms the environment. There were fully developed men, that is, of full intellect, emotion, and will, living at the same time, in your terms, as those creatures supposed to be man's evolutionary ancestors. However, as you begin to question the nature of time itself, then the quote-unquote when of the universe is beside the point. The motion and energy of the universe still comes from within. I certainly realize that this is hardly a scientific statement, yet the moment that all that is conceived of a physical system, it was invisibly created, endowed with creativity, and bound to emerge into physical reality. There is a design and a designer, but they are so combined, the one within the other, the one within and the one without, that it is impossible to separate them. The Creator is within its creations, and the creations themselves are gifted with creativity. The world comes to know itself, to discover itself, for the planner left room for divine surprise, and the plan was nowhere foreordained, nor is there anywhere within it anything that corresponds to your, quote, survival of the fittest, end quote, theories. Okay, so that was awesome. Rob now states, Seth's statement just given that fully developed men coexisted with their supposed ancestors led to our request that he follow through with more information on the subject. He's done so to some extent, and here we're presenting material from one of those later sessions to show his thinking. He continues to confound accepted evolutionary theory. As usual, however, Seth's new data obviously imply new questions that we haven't gone into yet, but at least, Rob told Jane, he's said certain things that we can ask questions about, whether from the viewpoint of evolution, time, language, civilization, or whatever. The excerpts to follow, incidentally, are those I referred to earlier in this appendix, when Rob had mentioned that Jane had supplemented Seth's material on early man with some of her own, which I did not read, okay? But matters not. Okay, so Seth states, in your terms of history, man appeared in several different ages, not from an animal ancestor in the way generally supposed. There were men animals, but they were not your stock. They did not, quote-unquote, lead to anything. They were species in their own right. There were animal men. The terms are for your convenience. In some species, the animal-like tendencies predominated. In others, the man-like tendencies did so. Some were more like men. Some more like the animals. The Russian steppes had a particular giant-sized species, some also, I believe, in Spain, in that area. There is some considerable confusion, for that matter, as to the geological ages as they are understood. Such species existed in many of these ages. Man, as you think of him, shared the earth with the other creatures just mentioned. In those terms, so-called modern man, with your skull structure and so forth, existed alongside of the creatures now supposed to be his ancestors. There was some rivalry among these groups, as well as some cooperation. Several species, say, of modern man died out. There was some mating among these groups, that is, among the groups in existence at any given time. The brain capacity of your particular species have always been the same. Many of the man-animal groups had their own communities. To you, they may seem to have been limited, yet they combined animal and human characteristics beautifully, and they used tools quite well. In a manner of speaking, they had the earth to themselves for many centuries, in that modern man did not compete with them. Both the man-animals and the animal-men were born with stronger instincts. They did not need long periods of protection as infants, but in an animal fashion were physically more agile at younger ages than, say, the human infant. The earth has gone through entire cycles unsuspected by your scientists. Modern man, then, existed with other man-like species and appeared in many different places on the earth and at different ages. There were then also animal man and man-animal civilizations of their kinds, and there were complete civilizations of modern man existing long before the ages now given for, say, the birth of writing. In 3100 BC. Okay, skipping a lot of notes. Hopefully you guys buy this book. But so right here, Rob says that as he was working on this particular appendix, Appendix 12, Seth had already remarked in the 709th session. Okay, so here's Seth. He stated, "You are well acquainted with the exterior method that involves studying the objective universe and collecting facts upon which certain deductions are made. In this book, therefore, we will be stressing interior ways of attaining not necessarily facts, but knowledge and wisdom. Now, facts may or may not give you wisdom. They can, if they are slavishly followed, they can lead you away from true knowledge. Wisdom shows you the insides of facts, so to speak, and the realities from which facts emerge." End quote. So that was from the 709th session. And that is where Appendix 12 stops. But there is lots and lots of notes. So lots more Seth quotes to come. Okay, so going into the notes in the appendix here, I'm skipping a lot of these. Alright, so note number 2, Rob is stating here that he had wrote in the introductory notes for volume 1 of this book that he thinks it is important to periodically remind the reader of certain of Seth's basic ideas throughout both volumes, stating that Seth's simultaneous time or spacious present is certainly such a concept. Yet in the next paragraph, Rob adds that in his opinion, Seth's concept of simultaneous time will always elude us to some extent, as long as we're physical creatures. To Rob, the challenge of confronting that idea is well worthwhile, for to grasp it, even partially, is bound to enlarge one's view of reality. And I couldn't agree more there. And he also says that a close analogy to this material can be found in remarks Seth made in the 682nd session for that first volume, where Seth had stated, quote, "The idea of one universe alone is basically nonsensical. Your reality must be seen in its relationship to others. Otherwise, you are always caught in questions like, how did the universe begin? Or when will it end? All systems are constantly being created." End quote by Seth. And also, Rob says to see the 688th session for Seth's discussion on closed systems and the backward and forward, inward and outward motions of time. Rob also adds that in light of the excerpts to come in this appendix from the 44th session, it should be noted that when Seth used the term, quote-unquote, camouflage, he referred not only to our physical world as one of the forms or camouflages taken by basic reality, but to another kind of time as well, the medium of successive moments the outer ego is used to, and in which our ordinary world exists. And for those of you who are interested in the first mentioning of quote-unquote camouflage by Seth, it is described in Volume 1. Rob also says to see Appendix 11, which I will get to as soon as I'm done with all of this appendix material for Volume 2. Okay, so note number 3, Rob states, in this 1964 session, Seth was several years away from any attempt to elaborate upon the vitality that, quote, composes from itself all other phenomena, end quote. In October 1969, he began his material on EE, or electromagnetic energy units. These, Seth declared, exist just below the range of physical matter and accrete in response to emotional intensity, eventually they form physical objects. He says to see sessions 504 to 506 in the appendix of the Seth material, and also the 581st session, chapter 20 of Seth Speaks. Also in volume 1, Seth carried this material a step further through his description of his CUs, or quote-unquote units of consciousness. From the 682nd session, Seth stated, quote, "I do not want you to think of these units as particles," end quote. And then also from sessions 683 to 84, definitely want to see those. And here's a little quote from those where Seth stated, quote, "There is a basic unit of consciousness that, expressed, will not be broken down," end quote. Okay, so skipping a lot of notes, going to note number 9. Rob states, Seth prepared the way for these statements by declaring in the 684th session in Volume 1, quote, "It is truer to say that heredity operates from the future backward into the past than it is to say that it operates from the past into the present. Neither statement would be precisely correct in any case, because your present is a poised balance affected as much by the probable future as the probable past." End quote. And note number 11, Rob says, both of these references originate in the first volume of this work. Seth, in session 681, stated, quote, "In your terms, the phrase is necessary. The moment point, the present, is the point of interaction between all existences and reality. All probabilities flow through it, though one of your moment points may be experienced as centuries or as a breath in other probable realities of which you are a part," end quote. And also Seth in session 683 stated, quote, "All kinds of time, backward and forward, emerge from the basic unpredictable nature of consciousness and are due to quote-unquote series of significances," end quote. Okay, so from note number 13, I'm just jumping right to the Seth quote. This is from session 803, so after Unknown Reality was completed. Seth said, quote, "You perceive your body as solid. Again, the very senses that make such a deduction are the result of the behavior of atoms and molecules literally coming together to form the organs, filling a pattern of flesh. All other objects that you perceive are formed in their own way in the same fashion. The physical world that you recognize is made up of invisible patterns. These patterns are quote-unquote plastic, in that while they exist, their final form is a matter of probabilities directed by consciousness. Your senses perceive these patterns in their own way. The patterns themselves can be quote-unquote activated in innumerable fashions. There is something out there to observe. Your sense apparatus determines what form that something will take, however. The mass world rises up before your eyes, but your eyes are a part of that mass world. You cannot see your thoughts, so you do not realize that they have shape and form, even as, say, clouds do. There are currents of thought as there are currents of air, and the mental patterns of man's feelings and thoughts rise up like flames from a fire, or steam from hot water, to fall like ashes or like rain. These patterns of probabilities themselves are not inactive. They are possessed by the desire to be actualized. Behind all realities, there are mental states. These always seek form, though again there are other forms than those you recognize. End quote. Okay, and jumping to note number 16, Rob states that in this appendix he's consistently thought of probabilities and reincarnation as being nearly synonymous, while hardly mentioning the latter to avoid making the material unnecessarily complicated. As Seth himself told us in the 683rd session for Volume 1 of this work, quote, reincarnation simply represents probabilities in a time context, portions of the self that are materialized in historical contexts. End quote. Note number 17, these excerpts from Seth's material in the 690th session for Volume 1 furnish a close analogy to the sort of quote-unquote time available to molecular consciousness. Quote, Seth stated, biological precognition is firmly based in the chromosomes and genes and reflected in the cells. The cells practically felt quote-unquote now includes then what you think of as past and future, as simple conditions of nowness. They maintain the body's structure in your poised time only by manipulating themselves in a rich medium of probabilities. There is a constant give and take of communication between the cells as you know it in present time, and the cell as it quote-unquote was in the past, or quote, will be, end quote. And final end quote for note number 17. All right, and then note number 18. First, Rob says that see the information on, quote, the true mental physicists, end quote, in session 701 for volume 1. Seth discussed how in our future such a scientist would be able to allow, quote, his consciousness to flow into the many open doors or inner realities that can be found with no instrument, but with the mind, end quote. And also, Seth commented in the same session that, quote, Rupert has at times been able to throw his consciousness into small physical instruments, computer components, for instance, and to perceive their interactivity at the level of, say, electrons, end quote. All right, and skipping the rest of those, and that's it. That is the end of Appendix 12. Holy crap. That was a lot of sifting and trying to figure things out, what I'm going to read, what not to read, and let me just tell you guys, I did not read everything, so I still think that you guys have to buy this book, but I will do my best. And the next appendix, Appendix 13, is super, super short. It is literally a page, one page, and the topic stated is Seth on the consciousness of trees. Ah, trees, my favorite. I love trees. Who doesn't love a tree? So, definitely look forward to that short little video that I will make for Appendix 13. Oh my gosh, finally a short one. And a lot of other ones that will be very long. So anyways, thank you for listening, you guys. I appreciate it so much. Definitely share this information. It is important. Much love. And I've been saying this word wrong. It's not equanimity. It's equanimity. Goodness. That's fine. Now I know. Much love.